We're very glad that you stayed for what's going to be sort of a free-fall session here, because we're going to be talking about archives and the nature of archives and the value of archives. And I'm thinking from talking to James earlier that there are things in the Tourget collection that aren't anywhere else. For instance, his notes for the Plessy versus Ferguson, his brief notes. And I think that Mark said that they didn't, no one really paid any attention to those until he found them in the papers. I think there's also a lot of social history in there. It's a very, very rich collection that's just beginning to be mined. We have a microfilm version of it that was done in the early 70s. And the way it was set up is the way the papers are kept today. Thank you. Now I can see you all. And well, that's fine. It reflects off my head anyway. But today, I've asked, well, let me introduce people. First of all, Heidi Bamford from the Western New York Library Resources Council. And she's been involved in archives for a long time. We both together have been involved.
I'm an archive.
Yeah. And Joni Blackman, who's the director of the Fenton Historical Society, who is a phenomenal fundraiser. And John Schmidt from Chautauqua Institution, who managed somehow to get the best archives facility in the county. So we're pleased to have all these people. And I've asked Heidi to start, and it's yours.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me here. As Jack said, my name is Heidi Bamford. I am the regional archivist for the Documentary Heritage Program. And basically what that is it's a field service for organizations that collect and preserve historical records. And I have six counties in the Western New York region that I'm responsible for in terms of making contact with people from these organizations and trying to help them figure out the best way to gather the resources they need to continue collecting and preserving the records that document the histories of their communities. And so, is Greg Peterson in here? I have had opportunities to work with the McClurg Museum, where the Tourget papers are, with the Jackson Center. Actually, I have a really embarrassing confession to make. When I was first contacted by Greg Peterson by email, actually I think it was Pam Brown who was helping him at the time, I didn't know anything about Robert Jackson either. And I remember telling someone, they had asked me a couple questions, preliminary questions, before I was to come out and do a site visit. And I remember vaguely emailing someone else to tell them that I was going to look at the Samuel L. Jackson collection. I knew there was an initial in there. And they said, really? That's kind of interesting. He's still alive. So I fixed that one in a hurry. I put the right name in the report. And so I had been working on and off with them ever since. And have come to know quite a bit about Robert Jackson and his legacy, as well as that of Albion Tourget. Also, I should point out to you that I've been working with archives. I started in the National Archives in 1988, 89, and I worked there for several years in various branches of the National Archives, and then I came back home. I actually am from Western New York, to work at the Documentary Heritage Program, so I've been doing this since 1990. From the time that I worked there at the National Archives, I did do a stint in the education branch, and I was working with putting together education materials for the Japanese internment and collection that was there. And from that moment forward, I've always been interested in the connection between historical records in the classroom and, you know, engaging students in learning. And so that continued over into my move back to Western New York and working with local history records, and feeling that, you know, part of my job was to advocate for local history records, and a way to do that is through the classroom. Well, a couple years ago, I also went back to school and got my teaching certification in social studies 7 through 12. So now I feel like I am more familiar with both the end of the spectrum that has the content material that could be used in the classroom, as well as now knowing more about the New York State curriculum, the national and state education standards, and the way a classroom actually operates. I've done student teaching and substitute teaching in various schools in the Western New York region. And in fact, the paper that I wrote for my degree in the program was primary sources in the classroom. And a lot of it was based on my experience here in Western New York as regional archivist and then as a teacher in the classroom. And I think that one of the things that the Tourjet story really helps bring home to us is that primary sources in the classroom at this point, I believe, are insufficient, inadequate, and do not engage students. There are a lot of teachers out there that are doing really amazing things with primary sources, but for the most part, we haven't had a lot of success in all the years that I've been involved in this in making primary source material a regular feature of classroom and hopefully lifelong learning, because I think that that's the whole object of learning in the classroom, is to continue on, you know, to develop that curiosity to learn, to acquire knowledge, to learn about right and wrong, and carry that forward as part of your character in the rest of your life. What I would say is that, you know, Tourjet has been overlooked, partly, again, this is my archivist part speaking, partly because the materials have been largely inaccessible and unknown. Most places like the McClurg Museum are severely underfunded, understaffed, and go through periods of administrations where everything changes. It's not just who's the director, but the finding aids, the priorities of collecting, the exhibit priorities, everything changes. And so things don't have a chance to develop and grow, and they're not... there's not enough support, whether through grants or local communities or whatever, to keep these operations going. And so a lot of it is that materials remain inaccessible and unorganized in small repositories around the country. And so there's great resources out there that people are fortunate to stumble upon, you know, through serendipity, as Greg said, in different ways, and come to find these treasures. But at the other hand, I would also say that the way that the education curriculum has been developed over the years, or has maintained itself over the years, doesn't offer us a chance, either teachers or parents or anyone else, administrators, school administrators, to make better use of these resources in the classroom. For example, one of the main reasons primary sources, or one of the main ways primary sources are used in the classroom, is our DBQs, document-based questions. And what it really comes down to is that the kids almost don't see a primary source until it's time to start reviewing DBQs. And then they show them photocopies of select numbers of documents and pose a question that implies that there's going to be one correct response, some convergent response to the question. And in the literature, people have cited one example, which I actually saw in place in one of the schools that I was student teaching at, a series of documents shown and asking the kids about the American Revolution and people's feelings as Americans. And so it's prepackaged materials, pre-selected, with the idea that this information has one correct response. And so students look at these unique resources as just another thing to memorize. They don't see the opportunity for discussion, for divergent views and perspectives. I think that one of the things that I saw when I was looking at these documents, if you look at the one on the first page, it's a typewritten letter that was sent to Albion Tourjet by a gentleman who had previously resided in the north and had come down south, like Mr. Tourjet himself, and had experienced quite a number of rude behaviors, so to speak, until he actually decided to give it up, and he was looking for a consular appointment, and he was looking for Turgot's endorsement. But he describes what had happened to him when he took his newspaper business and opened one up down south and supporting the Republican Party, and how he was abused and his business was basically run into the ground. And I could see this showing up on a test as a question or as a document, a single document by itself, where perhaps the question might read something like, how did Southern Democrats feel about the Republicans who were coming down from the North during the Reconstruction period in American history? Instead of saying something like, here's one example of a document of someone's experience living in the South, coming from the North, living as a Republican in the South, what kinds of things do you see as being negative experiences that this person is facing? Could these potentially be violations of this person's, you know, freedoms, or something more taking the perspective of what the person's actually going through, rather than making an inference about how Southern Democrats were feeling? Because this doesn't tell us how the Southern Democrats were feeling. It tells us how they were behaving. But you'd have to look at a letter, like some of the letters that are in the exhibit, where people are writing nasty letters to Albion Tourget. That would be more correctly identified as a document-based question. But, you know, it takes practice to sort of ask the right questions. But you have so many different documents here to select from that you could really offer the kids opportunities to look at different perspectives of what's going on at this period in history. Secondly, and so that's where I think that they're insufficient. There's not enough of them. If you're just using them for DBQs, and the way they're being used is DBQs, it really doesn't meet the needs of developing critical thinking skills among students and having them learn about multiple perspectives and being able to write essays based on that kind of those kinds of skills. The other thing with the inadequacy, I think that using primary sources, the way that they're currently used, that is, you know, somebody brings out a copy of an original document or a few pre-selected ones, it robs the documents of their historical context. And so it robs the students of their ability to connect with the time period itself and their ability to understand what's happening. Okay, it doesn't look as threatening, but if you see a whole ream of a whole box of letters, one after the other, where Albion Tourget is being threatened or people are telling their horrific stories of what's happening to them, then the threatening atmosphere aspect, the context, is developed for the students. One letter, it's like, well, you know, I get a nasty letter from somebody once in a while, or they text message each other nasty little messages, so it's not very threatening. But if they see this repeatedly, I think it gives them a better sense of the context. Now, the argument, counter-argument that's used in education is there's no time because of the standards. And a lot of it is also that they feel students would be too challenged in trying to work through this kind of material. Well, I have a fifth grade daughter who is learning math that I learned in high school. So if she can meet the challenges in math, I think she can certainly meet the challenges in reading comprehension and critical thinking in terms of working with primary sources. In fact, they're my little guinea pigs. I bring them with me to some of my site visits and have shown them some of these documents. I just told somebody I made my one daughter read the Robert Jackson book for summer reading. And so they are certainly capable of it. And I think that really and truly, kids need to be immersed in this kind of stuff. You don't really get a sense of who Albion Tourget is or who Robert Jackson is unless you really go through multiple sources or multiple documents to really get a sense of the before and after and during of these people's lives. And I think another example that I have here is, and here's another connection, we talk about parallels and connections today. I have come across a collection at the Niagara County Historical Society in Lockport, New York, and it's based on the Mossel family. And the Mossel family there's a family portrait in this packet of documents that you have here. There should be, right? There is? Yes, okay. And Aaron Mossel was actually a son of, he and his wife were the children of former slaves. Their parents had been freed. They lived in Baltimore, Maryland. They moved to Hamilton, Ontario during the Civil War because they felt like they were not having the opportunities to work or be educated in the United States that they could have. So they lived in Hamilton for a number of years, came back after the Civil War, and settled in Lockport, New York. I don't, do people know where, you know, your local people, right? So Lockport, New York, which is north of here. And he was a brick maker, and he bought a business from a man in Lockport, brick making business, this Aaron Mossel. And so he was the brick maker in the town. He had this big business. He donated bricks to build the school that was used for the white students. And he was a pretty well-known. He owned a lot of real estate in Lockport. It was pretty well-known. And he petitioned, and there is a copy of the petition in here. It's the handwritten document, or the notes. These are the minutes from the Lockport Board of Education, where Mr. Mossel petitions to allow his children, and actually it's his grandchildren, to attend the white school, which was directly across the street from where his house was, instead of having to attend the colored children's school, which was across town. Okay, this is in 1871, and Mr. Mossel is petitioning the board, and he is turned down, but he continues to petition the board. And in fact, he also exercises his rights as an American citizen to express his opinion in the newspaper, to send out a petition with other citizens in the community, and to have a little protest. One day, in this newspaper article, you'll see there is his intention. It's let me see my copy. His name is at the bottom of the article, but that is where he tells them that the next day, or the next week, the next following Monday, that all of the children, the colored children of Lockport, are going to attend the white schools that are nearest them with their parents, in protest, and they do this, and it's reported in the paper the next day that they appeared, and they were in the schools. They were not taught, and they were sent home. And it was by rule of the board that it was determined that the current situation should continue as it is. That the superintendent had the right to ask these children to continue going to the separate school. Eventually, though, to tell you what happens, in 1876, Aaron Mossel actually is successful. And in 1876, the African-American children in the city of Lockport are attending the same school as the white children in the city of Lockport due to his efforts. Now, the story doesn't end there, because what happens is his three children all go on to become professionals. His oldest son, Charles, becomes a minister. And he goes to Haiti to do his ministry, and he also writes a book about Louis Toussaint Louverture, the revolutionary hero of Haiti, and he dedicates the book to Albion Tourge, which is on the back of, I think it's the last handout here. So obviously he had read Tourge, he knew about Tourge, he was inspired by Tourge. It was his children that were allowed to go to school. Inspired by Tourge, went on to get his children educated, and in the same way that the white children of the city of Lockport were. Charles's two brothers, Aaron, became the first African-American graduate of law school at Penn State. His other brother, Charles, became the first African-American graduate of the medical school at Penn State, who was also part of the 10 that started the Niagara Movement. He's in the famous portrait with W.E.B. Du Bois, and he's identified as a physician in Philadelphia, which he was at the time. And Aaron's daughter, Sadie Tanner Mossel Alexander, became the first female, African-American female, to earn a Ph.D. from Penn State. She became a lawyer also and served on three presidential commissions. One was under Truman, where he had the executive order integrating the armed services. Her second commission was the Kennedy Civil Rights Commission in 1963, and her third was Carter's Commission on Aging. And so it's really an ironic situation that, you know, here in Western New York, we have all of these accounts that are there waiting to be told to students. I mean, I think, you know, the way people told these stories today are perfect ways to you know, talk to school students, tell them about these kinds of stories, let them look for. The Turgay papers are filled with letters, and I gave you two examples of letters that were sent, one from New York, so in the north, and the other from, I think, the south. Examples of letters from people all over the country. I mean, they could be used in the schools in those different communities where they came from to teach students about what was really happening during Reconstruction. We make it sound like, oh, it was all the failure of Reconstruction, Reconstruction's fault. But we were, I mean, the American public was, you know, part of that thing and still is. And so I think it gives the students some sense of the deeper meaning of what was happening in their communities and communities like theirs across the country. Now, I'm going to quit because I know short time. Sorry.
I'm going to ask Joni to talk next. The I mentioned to you that she was a tremendous fundraiser, and things have really been happening down to Fenton Historical Society in Jamestown. But she's recently worked on a grant, and I would like her to talk about that, the whole granting procedure. And
well, I'm playing Michelle Henry right now. That's why it doesn't make sense on your program. We received a Institute of Museum and Library Services federal grant this past year in August for processing 30 years of backlog of archives, donations. That's not meaning things in the archives that just go back 30 years for what they are. What it means is anything donated in the past 30 years. So think about your house and your closets and under your beds and all around where you have things stuffed that you are going to get to someday. We have 30 years of that, and it's all paper and photographs and other primary documents. And so we've been trying to get this taken care of for probably the past 20 years. So so I finally said, let's try it. So I worked with the Jamestown Public School System because we have no space to do this project. We're going to need to spread out for miles, I think, for all these different boxes that we have. We have about 300 cubic feet of 300 banker's boxes, let's put it that way, of things that need to be taken care of. They're in good shape now. It's just we don't know exactly what they all are because they come in and you don't have enough staff to take care of them at the time, and you set them aside and say, I have the best intentions of getting to that, and now it's three decades later, and finally we're going to get to it. So how are we going to do that? Well, my staff member, Karen Livesey, who's a librarian and an archivist, she's a librarian, she does archivist on the side, which is a very, very good job. She had a plan. She's been working on this for a decade in her head on how she's going to get this done. And so we called up the Jamestown Public School System, our friend Pam Brown, who's their records management person and archivist for the school system, and said, Pam, you have a brand new records area with space. Could we work out a deal? And so how these grants work, in many cases, you need a match. So I mean, many of you may already know that. So I wrote this grant for $216,000 over 2 years, and the federal government will pay $96,000 of that, $216,000. The rest is matches in space rental that we would normally pay Jamestown Public Schools, but we're going to use that space for 2 years. And then we're also going to put in some money from Fenton budget that would already go towards the archivist area, archival work, and towards the library work. And we're going to pay Pam Brown to supervise some volunteers for us. And Karen will work on some of the more difficult collections, the more complicated collections, and she'll prepare the less complicated collections for other people to work on. And how it helps the school is Pam gets a little bit of her time paid for, but also Pam will be able to keep track of, have an overview of what is coming out of all these boxes, this 30-year accumulation, and see what fits with the curriculum for the school system and what those children need to see as a primary document. They have a huge website many, many pages of all kinds of primary documents that the teachers can access to use. I mean, it's hundreds of things. Have you seen it, Heidi? The one Pam Brown scanned all those maps and everything under the sun she scanned and put up there. It's huge. And so she's going to add to that because she knows what the gaps are. And so she's going to use our collections to do that, which we think is great. And so that will help the school system out, and they're happy for that. It also helps us see where the gaps are in our collection. We know there's a lot of industries we do not have any information on or pictures of. So it'll help us identify, for instance, that we need to go after certain companies' archives or find out someone who worked there and get some information from them and start to follow those threads to get more information. And so there are many of those. And so going through all these boxes will help us do that. It's not a, how do I say this? It's going to be a long haul. It's going to take 2 years to do it. It's going to be exciting to see what comes out of it. I have part of the trouble with our match is part of it is state member item money. And given what the state's going through right now, I'm not sure if I'm going to have to find an additional $50,000 because that was what the member item is. So that's something I have to think about. But when you're looking for funding for projects, and I may not be telling a lot of you anything new, you really have to look at what you want to do, how does it fit with the mission of the funders you have to choose from, and don't follow the money and get off the mission. Don't chase the money. Stick with the mission. And it's hard to do that sometimes. This is a Museums for America grant, which just started up with IMLS probably 2-3 years ago. And I wrote, it was more than that. It was first year I was director. First 2 weeks I was director, I put in a IMLS Museums for America grant and got turned down flat. I knew I would because it was the first attempt at it. I knew I would. So it's taken me 4 years to get the nerve back up again and figure out how to write for them, what do they want to see, but yet still keep, I can still stay on mission. So that's what we've done with that archives grant. Does that help you?
Yeah.
Okay.
John, you recently got a wonderful new building up there and probably pulled things out of the closet. You might describe the conditions you have, but then maybe you could talk about what smaller institutions, smaller little historical societies could do with items they have and how, with probably no money, they can best protect their collections.
Well, thank you. And I have to say, this is the first time I've been on a panel where I actually agree entirely with the other people that are on it. It's a nice change. I'm a corporate archivist. That means I don't work in public repositories. Basically, most of my work has been in the nonprofit sector, although I've done some for profit corporations as well. And it is typical in both situations. And this, that you have to make a lot out of a very small budget that you have. And that's basically the case, too, for local history societies, local historians trying to preserve their records. The preservation of the documents necessary not only to learn about the past, but to document the accuracy of accounts of the past is probably really the most important job that we have, the most serious responsibility that we're given as archivists. But it can't be separated out from the rest of what we do because it's the actual overall program itself that is necessary for preserving the records. Without the archives functioning and the program surviving, the records have little chance of surviving, certainly very little chance of ever being found or used. But before I begin, I'd like to make a distinction between conservation and preservation management. Conservation is really a technical science that tells you what will happen to certain materials under certain conditions if you do this or you don't do that over a certain period of time. I am going to be talking about preservation management, which is what the archivist does. The archivist takes that knowledge but balances it with the value of the records, the use of the records, how they're used, and the availability of resources to the archives. Only the archivist can make the final decision as to what should be done for the preservation of records. And any really good conservator will tell you that. That conservation simply will tell you what is going to happen as a matter of fact. The difficult decisions are really left to the archivist to make. To begin with, though, for this program that you need, you have to have, obviously, a mandate or a mission statement. You have to be clear about what the purpose of your archives is. And from that, you define an acquisition policy, which I think is the most important first step towards preservation. Most small archives have preservation problems because they've had very aggressive, or perhaps better put, very loose acquisition practices, more or less taking everything. You really should only take that which you feel you are the best suited to take. You are the best repository. And one of the considerations is the issue of preservation. To be able then to have a clear focus limits the amount of material you have. It makes the material you have relate better to itself, and it will define, in almost every case, the priorities that you need to worry about for preservation. And that's something that's usually often not done, particularly in the case of local historical societies. Now, it helps to network at that point, to attend days like today, or to go to workshops, NIAC, whatever, and meet other people who have museums, libraries, and archives, so that when something comes your way, you can give it maybe to another institution that's better suited. For example, we had several maps offered to us a few years ago that would have required some care, not a lot, but some care. And the Fenton has a much better map collection for the county than we do and didn't have these maps. So I didn't take the maps. I instead sent the person down to Jamestown where they gave it to the Fenton, and that got it off my table as well. Thanks. But it really did put it in the right place, you know. So when someone wants maps, they're not going to be coming to me. They're more likely to be going to the Fenton. That's where it belonged. You also need to know your holdings, and you have to know not just their physical condition, but you have to know their value. And not only what records are used, but specifically how they're used and why they are used. It's important to be clear, I think, on the difference between the evidential value and the informational value of a record, because it will determine the importance of actually investing in the preservation of the record itself. If it's evidential, for instance, the Constitution of the United States, it's pretty important to keep that piece of paper safe. If, on the other hand, the only value is really the information that it contains, that opens up other options, including preservation copy, where you make a copy which you think at some point may actually be the only surviving copy of the record, but it's a copy, but it's a preservation copy. Or you can also probably consider making reference copies so that you can vault the original, it's not being handled, and researchers instead using the preservation. But you have to understand what the researcher needs from that record to make a decision like that. You also need to know your whole holdings in order to be able to set your priorities. And it can't be said enough that in archives, it isn't the question of knowing what to do under the ideal circumstances, although that's important to know. It really boils down to making the best use of what's available to you, what resources you have. And that's why you should never in archives have the attitude, I can't do anything. You can always do something, and if you're doing the best thing and you're doing the best you can do, you're performing excellently. That is what excellence means in archives. It does not mean having endless resources, and you can't expect that. Whether it's coming from the public purse or it's coming from a private source, you have to be able to make the best use of what you have. Speaking of use, that is the greatest threat to records, is actually their being handled. Of acid deterioration, which started with pulp paper in 1850, where the paper turns brown and brittle. The acid deterioration from the lignin in that pulp paper does not destroy the paper. What destroys the paper is it becoming brittle, and then it's destroyed by use. Virtually most of the catastrophic stories of relating to archival records involve some sort of damage through use. And that means you have to have a place, a reading room, and that can be very difficult. And if you don't have a reading room, That really restricts what records you can responsibly have. You might have to think of moving. You might have to think of some way of making arrangements where a room could be borrowed at least for part of the week or whatever for that purpose. You have to have rules on how to handle things. It helps if you have a photocopier so that people can actually make copies rather than having to only use the originals. A beveled edge is a very simple thing to have on a photocopier today where you don't have to flatten the book, for example. The equipment of this sort is much friendlier if you search for it for archives. And you have to remember that when most records are damaged primarily through use, we archivists, we're the ones who usually are the guiltiest because we're handling them far more than anyone else, and there's no one who's ever worked in archives for any period of time that hasn't had some horrible accident happen at some point, either through carelessness or sometimes through just the most curious of coincidences. But use is got to be controlled because that's the first greatest danger. Then you can have disasters. That you can have animals come in and eat things, and you can have insects come in, and you can have mold. Basically, the trick about mold is you have to have condensation to have mold. You're looking at the dew point where there's a beginning of condensation you can't even see. Water globules, that's all the mold needs. You have mold in your records. You will never get rid of your mold. Your mold, hopefully, is dormant, and you just keep it dormant by monitoring the conditions that the records are in to prevent that from happening, to not let that dew point be reached. If it is, you have 48 hours before the mold will start to grow, so you must move quickly. There are a variety of things to do that I won't go into right now. Basically, just you should be, if you have any holdings, you should have a disaster plan, and you can go to places like Munters, and they will help you, or go to any conservator at a university. They'll be able to help you with some basic guidelines that should be in a disaster plan. Remember, too, that a disaster plan doesn't necessarily mean that your whole archives is underwater. It can mean just one pipe breaking in one area. It's still, you should have procedures already worked out as to how to treat those records. You only really need, for your disaster recovery plan, to worry about water. If your archives burn up, your problem solved. You know, I've always said there's no problem in archives too big that a big fire couldn't solve, you know. And you don't really need to worry too much. You can have smoke damage, you can have heat damage in some cases. But essentially, really, it is water that you need to be able to have a plan in place. And again, you only have a 48-hour window once your records are wet. Then there's this thing called internal vice, which is the degeneration of a record just by the chemical breakdown, like vinegar syndrome on acetate film, or the curling, the cracking of emulsions on a photographic print, acid deterioration. There's a basic rule for all internal vice, and that is you try to reduce or minimize the catalysts of change. And the catalysts of change are heat and light. There's a rule, Van't Hoff's rule, which is that for every increase of temperature of 10 degrees Celsius, you double the speed of the chemical reaction. So if for every 10 degrees Celsius that you decrease the temperature, you will actually be cutting in half the time of the deterioration. You'll be doubling the life of the record. By that theory, if you put it in absolute zero, it would last forever. And there is such a thing as deep cold storage in archives. It's, I think, a very questionable, even in the best of circumstances, method, but you aren't going to be doing that. The trouble with keeping your storage area too cold is that when you pull those records out for the reading room, it's going to be too much of a jump in temperature, and the reading room can be kept at maybe 67, 68, but anything lower than that, people are going to be complaining it's too cold. Mm-hmm. So you want to reduce the fluctuation from the storage area to the reading room. This is far more, the reason why I'm mentioning this is far more important than people often realize. You can actually have an at that moment disaster if you're not careful, changing environments quickly. And the reason is simply that most records we have are complex materials, like a book has string, glue, cardboard, leather, paper, etc. in it. And if you change the temperature or humidity quickly, all of those materials expand or shrink at different speeds. And that puts an enormous amount of pressure on it and will wrinkle the paper, for example, or it will crack the back of a book, much more than what people are actually often aware of. I once walked from the library to the archives with some papers of no importance in my hand, walked in, started talking, went over to get the papers. They were all wrinkled up. I had gone from a humid air outside into the controlled dry, cool air inside the reading room, and within 5 minutes, the papers have been damaged by that sudden change. It can happen extremely quickly. In general, I would say also light is one you really have to be very careful of. If you've looked at a book and you see around the edges it's yellow, that's because the light has gotten there. Particularly for acid deterioration, keep it out of the light. Blueprints, you can lose a blueprint in 30 minutes if you have it out in the sunlight. We're talking about UV light. It's great if you have UV inhibitors in the glass that are in any area. But if you don't, be careful that you don't put records in direct sunlight. And also, unless you work from sunrise to sunset, be careful where the sun comes through at all times of the day, even maybe before you get into work or after you leave. Again, that damage can be done extremely quickly if you're not careful. Light is, of course, also very bad for any photosensitive material or basically any plastics. You don't have to be worried about the lights fluorescent lights, because they almost always have a case. Now, if they don't have a covering, you have a problem. But if they have a covering, there are UV inhibitors in that plastic, or else the plastic would turn yellow. So the manufacturers put them in, and there tends to be a very low light. You can check, though, with a UV handheld monitor. In general, too, though, I personally recommend air circulation. Some conservators think they can treat an environment and then seal it. You're always taking a chance when you seal anything. You need to look at all your holdings once in a while, move things around a little, make sure you have airflow in all parts of your facility. When I first started, there was a building that had a very bad mold problem. I was called, I said, "Have there been any renovations on this building?" "Yeah, we just fixed it up in the spring." They had sealed it, and it had been fine for years and years. They had their books and other textiles there. It was great. No problem. They fixed the building, sealed it. Again, the summer, they had the doors open, warm, moist air coming in. They locked it up for the winter. The temperature drops outside. Condensation occurs inside, and they had mold. A very serious mold outbreak. It can happen very quickly. There are three rules, though, that I'll finish with that are important. The first is the rule of reversibility. Don't ever do anything you can't undo, unless you're told by a conservator to go ahead and do it. And you're aware of the consequences. But that means Japanese paper mending. You can undo it. Use water-soluble adhesives if you use any adhesives at all. By the way, I just mentioned that, though. Adhesives, whenever you see adhesives, try to get them out. If you've got envelopes and you have to keep the envelopes, at least maybe cut off the top part so that you don't have the glue there. Is it really important to keep that? I don't think so, and you're taking quite a risk. When you have photographs in envelopes, it can be very hard to change a whole collection of those. At least turn it so that the photographic emulsion side is facing the inside of the envelope rather than the side that has the internal adhesives. Any adhesives, though, they spread acid. They also are very bad if they get wet. Anyway, the first rule is rule of reversibility. Don't do anything you can't undo. Second rule is the mending rule. which is really, you don't patch anything with a material that is stronger or weaker than the material being patched. That's the original mending rule. We use that in mending and taping and archives, but also there's the extended mending rule, which is make sure that your solution isn't bigger than your problem. Because this happens a great deal when people go out and get professional advice. They have plans now that are unrealistic, and instead of doing important minor steps, they end up doing nothing at all. And most of all, know what you know what you don't, and then know when to ask for help. Thanks.
Very good.
When I was in high school in Jamestown, there was a thing called the mimeograph machine. And that's how you made copies of things for people. Then I guess I went to a graduate program, and they had punch cards. And you would punch out certain categories and then put a wire needle through and pull out the ones that had the information on you wanted. And then life kept going on, and things kept happening. And then I went to work one day, and my librarian had put a computer on my desk. And I didn't touch it for a year, because I do not like machines. And then along came more advanced microfilming techniques, and then the CD, the scanning, has developed. In fact, at the Historical Society, we are scanning it right now, the Elial Todd Foote collection. And we'll probably be able to put it online on a web page and also have microfilm. And I think this is great. But you want to know something? In 10, 15 years, it's going to be history. And we're going to be having another system to record and to save archives. Now, I'd like to ask our two speakers. Now, they've been all over the country. They've looked at many, many different archives. They've dealt with many different archivists. And archivists can be very obstreperous. And I'd like them to make a couple brief comments. We've got about 10 minutes left. A couple brief comments about some of their experiences with archives and archivists. You can say anything you want.
Well, it's...
No names.
I know. I actually, the story that I'm thinking of, I absolutely can't tell you the name of the archive or the institution, but it's something that's going on right now with me. From a scholar's point of view, you know, what you need to know from an archive is, first of all, what's in it, you know? And the more detailed a description of the archive and the items, the better. The Tourget papers have very poor guide. It was done in 1964. It does not give you very much information. And so, in fact, that one is very difficult to use, and I don't think it's used very much by scholars because of that. And just one example of that, and I'm going to tell you this story about the frustrating experience I'm in the middle of in a second. But I was mentioning before this panel that the oral arguments that Albion Tourget made to the Supreme Court in Plessy v. Ferguson, he typed up on big note cards, and they're in the exhibit right now.
Emma typed them up?
Emma, his wife, probably typed up for him. He didn't like to use the machine himself. They are in the archive. Now, I don't believe that they're listed in the index under Plessy or anything to do with Plessy. Across the top of it says argument of A.W. Tourget. Every book I've ever read on the Plessy case, no one's ever cited this. In fact, most books on the Plessy case say that Tourget never appeared before the Supreme Court. He sent a brief, which is in the papers there in the U.S. Supreme Court, but there's no record of him at the oral argument. Well, go to the Tourget papers, page through them all, one by one, page by page, like I did, and you will find the oral arguments that are clearly the arguments he made in the Plessy case that expand upon the points of the brief, and clear records of, I know, when he left, when he got there, what happened, when he got back. I know that he went to Washington, D.C., and he argued the case and who was there with him. But it wasn't accessible for all of the scholars who wrote on the Plessy case. So that great source of understanding the arguments in that case is, until very recently, never been used. Now, You need to know what's in these archives so that scholars can know, and you know, if a keyword like Plessy, anything connected with it, if it was really easily marked and keyworded, then people researching that case could find it very easily. And then we need to be able to somehow get a hold of the documents. And people can't always travel to an archive. Now, the Tourget papers are on microfilm, which makes it easier. But some items, or other archives, or you don't have them microfilmed, or they can be sent out or looked at easily, you request that they photocopy and send it to you, and you pay whatever they ask. And sometimes that's a very difficult process. There's a letter Albion Tourget wrote to a fairly prominent black leader, and I came across reference to this letter 4 years ago. And I called the archive where this reference suggested the letter was. Left a message. I didn't get a phone call. I looked, went to the, I didn't get a return call. I went to the internet, found out who the contact person was. I wrote them a message. I said, I'm writing this book. I'd really like to see this letter. It seems very important. Didn't get a response. Wrote more emails, more phone calls. I thought if I would just harass them, maybe they were on vacation. I finally gave up. A couple weeks ago, somebody who wrote a book on this important leader, who I won't name because it will give away the archive, wrote to me because she had a question about Tourget, and I said, did you go into the papers? Did you find this letter? And she said, let me look at my notes. Oh yeah, that letter's there, but I don't have a copy of it, but I can give you the name of the person to call at the archive. But here we are, years later, I'm going to get this letter. So I had the phone number of somebody different. I called her. She said, oh, you'll have to leave a message for the head archivist, which is the same person who never returned my calls before. And I said, well, can you please do it? I can't believe I have someone on the phone from this archive. It's in a distant part of the country, which I cannot travel to. And you've read this letter. Could you please, I beg you, just go copy it or bring this to her. No, you have to leave. I don't want to step on her toes. You just have to leave a message for her on her phone. That was a week ago, and she hasn't returned my calls. So that's the frustration of doing research, is that it depends on who you get, and it depends on how the institution is run and the accessibility and the helpfulness. You know, it can be frustrating. It can be that you never get to see some evidence that you know exists and is important.
It's, I said archivists were obstreperous. I work with an institution in a major university, one of the 10 major universities in the country, and my work that I'm doing with the Seneca Indians. And this is an institution that you get to and you have to break at 10 o'clock to have tea. So you lose half an hour there and they close for lunch, but they do not even have a scanner. And this is major. They're still in the 19th century. Carolyn, what experiences have you had?
Well, I think my best experience with an archive was at the Boston Public Library when I was working on the Lydia Maria Child papers. The conditions were not particularly agreeable there. The light was poor, and I got one of the archivists to bring me a light so that I could actually read these letters. And again, the hours were short, the nearest bathroom was 15 minutes walk away, yeah. And so forth. But what was wonderful about this was the anti-slavery collection at the Boston Public Library, was that the people, the abolitionists who donated their papers knew how important their materials were, and the librarians who received them probably were very close to these people in time. So you have these little index cards. All of the letters in the collection were indexed by whom they were from, whom they were to, and who was mentioned in the letters. So I had access to Lydia Maria Child's letters, which were on microfiche, but I didn't have access to the letters of her associates. And I was I was researching her editorship of the National Anti-Slavery Standard. And what you find in that collection is letters that her associates were writing back and forth to each other, complaining about her or complaining about each other or praising her. And so thanks to these little index cards, I knew exactly where to look to find this, because otherwise there were just thousands and thousands of documents in there, and I wouldn't have had any sense of where to look. I'd like to pick up on your talk on using archives in the classroom, and as you were talking, I was thinking about what materials in the Tourget collection might be usable in a classroom. And one of the things that crosses my mind, and Mark has talked about this too, when Tourget was running the National Civil Rights Association that he founded, he received hundreds, if not thousands, I would say, of letters, some from leading African-American intellectuals and reformers, others from obscure, barely literate people in the South. And I think taking one of these misspelled, very short letters from somebody in Mississippi or Louisiana, writing to Tourget, telling what the conditions were there, and saying, you know, that he wants to join the National Civil Rights,
the
NCRA, that it's very dangerous, and please take X or X precautions in sending material back to him. This would be a wonderful resource for students. And it would also be very empowering, because it shows you what literacy can accomplish, and how even somebody who's barely literate who can make a difference by using that knowledge. If I could use one other example, now I don't know in what kind of classroom these letters could be used, but there is a very large group of love letters between Tourget and his then fiance that were being used. And the letters are full of their sexual life and their sexual feeling. This, I think, would be better in a college classroom probably than in a primary school classroom. But these are a wonderful resource, and they do tell you about sexuality in the 19th century in ways that really defy your expectations of the kinds of rules that people observed or didn't observe, the kinds of feelings that women especially had or didn't have. Those are the kinds of primary documents that I think would be wonderful to use in some kind of classroom.
That's another interesting thing in the Tourget collection. I hadn't thought of that for a long time, since I didn't sex up my book with that particular set of issues. But I, when I first read those, I went to Martha Hodes, who's a leading historian of sexuality in the country, and I said, I can't believe how frank these letters are. Did 19th century Americans really, you know, I didn't have that much experience as a graduate student reading so many letters. She said, no, that sounds really unusual, you know. And so that's yet another way that the Tourget letters, the history of sexuality is now, you know, one of the most thriving new fields, and who knows, you know, how those could be used. But again, there's no subject sexuality and letters listed for somebody doing that research.
Now, I have, as an archivist, I have to get on your case, both of you. what you experienced, the 3x5 cards, is a very 19th century thing. And when you listen to Joni talk about 30 cubic feet of records, you're lucky 300. Well, another year's work.
Yeah.
But what you're going to get is an inventory, and maybe broken down, you know, this folder contains correspondence for this year and that year. But it's practically, because of lack of money and staff, it's practically impossible to do the kind of work that you know, at the college, kids would come in to me the day before a paper was due, and they would say, I have to write a paper about that sculpture that's in front of this building. And I said, well, we have information. And I'd take them down a folder about this thick. And They wanted instant gratification. Mm-hmm. They wanted one piece of paper that would tell them everything. They didn't want to research. And that, can I take this folder out overnight? Can you copy the whole thing for me? And I would just look at them and I would smile and I say, you know, you're going to flunk this one. With no pity. I want you all to thank our panelists. I think we've had some very exciting and interesting comments. And if you have any questions, please see the particular person as we rise. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you very much.